RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Friday morning at RCR means our political panel, a political agenda. Plenty to chew on this morning. Joining us on the panel, Alfred Ngaro is back. Hi, Alf, how are you?
Morena, Paul, and morena to all our listeners in RCR.
Yeah, Simon O'Connor, Speak Free. He'll be jumping into the studio after this to do the program. Hi, Simon.
G'day, Paul. Great to be here. Great to be here with Alfie. It's a bit of a reuniting of the 2011 National Party crowd.
Okay. Should we just stand aside for a moment and you guys can bond again or something?
We just have a personal moment after all these years, yeah. Anyway.
And Marie Buskey. Hi, Marie.
Good morning, Paul.
You've been teaching the kids to drive, Marie.
Oh, I have.
How's that been going?
For someone of my age and stature, it is not good for one's blood pressure, but we are getting there.
Right. Okay. Are they showing instinctive driving skills at this stage?
One, yes. One is not so much.
Okay. Who was it that Mr. Magoo, remember him? The cartoon of Mr. Magoo and him driving blind. He seemed to avoid everything.
Yeah. That's all
I know
good.
How you do that.
It is all
yeah.
good.
All right, we're here to talk about some of the political stories here and from around the entire planet. Let's start with this one, Māori Queen, Alf. So she's the youngest of the three children, as I understand it, of King Tuhaetia VII. Got any thoughts about her in the role?
Yeah, look, it was an amazing time. The coronation, as well as the tangi, the funeral that was held yesterday down in Turangawaewae and Ngarawahia. You're right, Paul, she is the youngest, but she was groomed. She's been groomed for, you know, probably the last 2 years and for that role. You know, she's 27, but she's already got a BA. She's got a master's in Māori tikanga. She's on a number of governance boards. So at 27, she's the second Māori queen. You have to realise that the whole Kingitanga movement is the oldest Māori political sort of initiative in an institution since 1858. And it was purposely initiated to find a way to unify Māori in a particular way, to deal with land confiscation and other elements of that. And, you know, the late Māori king, Kingi Tuheitia, he finally found his rhythm and his place of purpose when he realised kotahitanga was the key role of the kingitanga movement, to try and unite them together. And as you know, that's actually what that movement has been. So, look, she's young, but she's got good support around her and people who are wise. And I think when I was down there yesterday, just a real excitement amongst a number of rangatahi young people, but also to people who experience and say, you know, we're going through a time now where if ever there was a time to unite and unify Māori voices together, this is that time. And so, you know, a lot of expectations, and we look forward to seeing what's going to happen. The Kingitanga movement, especially with Ngāti Hoa and Wurumu Tamihana, he was the one that was a huge driver around this. And really, this was a way of, again, unifying Māori leadership for their not just political aspirations, but also to for the good of Māori throughout the community. And the last thing to say is that, you know, we need to see this not as a threat, but as a great opportunity to see if we can grow together as a nation, which is one of the challenges at the moment politically that we're having to be challenged by. Yeah.
I know nothing about Kuini Ngā Waihono e Te Pō, but age and gender, is she woke?
Well, I couldn't tell you that. But I have to say that, you know, I've watched her just on my way back home yesterday, and I just started to look at a couple of interviews that she's had. You know, she is young, but actually there's a sincerity. She travelled with her father over to the coronation of King Charles. She was at the FESPAC, which is the Pacific Festival over in Hawaii. And as she was going there, she was engaging. You know, she was, again, that's part of their grooming. And she was putting herself in a place where she could be a contributor. So, yeah, can't answer whether she's woke or not.
I know.
Yeah. I have to
but
say,
you got asked these days, right? You do.
Wokeness, because let's just talk about what it is that they actually, what does it actually mean?
Mm. Well, one of the things I wanted to know, Alfred, the sense of her, is there's that real schism within Māoridom at the moment between those more traditional conservative Māori and those new kōhanga generation that have come through. And there's a lot of push me, pull me, and you even see that within families. I mean, you know, one just needs to look at the Jackson clan to see how that manifests. How do you think she'll navigate that being so young, you know, that from those who have more radical ideas on one side in terms of tenaranga, teratanga versus kotahitanga and conservatism on the other? Do you think she'll be able to navigate that?
Yeah, so thanks, Marie. It's a really good question, because actually that's what people were asking about down there. And you could see it on the paipai, the different speakers who were speaking. Look, there was one speaker who actually said a whakatokia Māori proverb, and it starts off by saying that, you know, the old net needs to now move aside to make way for the new net. And he said people then stopped there. But the full proverb says, but the young net, the new net, needs to ask the old net, where are the fish? Hmm. And so the truth is, it's not an either or, it's an and, right? Hmm. And I think that's going to be important, that people need to be careful. While the energy of youth is important and the enthusiasm, you actually need some wise heads. Wisdom comes from often making mistakes, and you get that becomes your experience. So I think there are a number of people who are very conscious of that. And so, yeah, we'll see how we go. But, you know, all the Māori Honihara Weta was down there, you know, Rawiri Waititi, they're all inside the tent. In fact, they carried the casket out as well. But at the same time too, you know, I listened to some other people who are saying, you know, let's pull back for what we know has been allowed us to sustain the Kingitanga movement over years. And often there have been these conservative values.
Simon.
Yeah, look, I think the big challenge is going to be expectations on her. And that's what happens whenever the baton's passed on. So, you know, she's got a lot of experience, even for a 28-year-old, as Alfred said. So that's holding her in good stead. But there are, I think Marie's touched on something quite critical. There's a whole lot of competing expectations on her. And don't forget, Kingitanga is not for all Māori. Different iwi will acknowledge themselves before the Kingitanga movement. So she's an important voice, but she's not the voice. And the only other thing I'd add is Her Majesty the Queen, or the late Majesty Queen Elizabeth, was 25 when she took took the throne. So there's a history of young women taking over and doing a good job.
That was a different time, though, Simon. Different time.
Oh, look, absolutely a different time. And, you know, someone like Elizabeth was years and years and years of preparation. So it is different. And look, let's be clear too, the New Zealand Crown, you know, now King Charles, is different to the Kingitanga movement. They're not equivalent. So look, she's got a lot of expectations. It's just my hope that constructive approach is adopted with government, because if we continue down what's sort of the Rawiri Waititi and Honihara Wera line, it's not going to end particularly well. So let's see what she can do.
Anything more to say about this before we skip on to the next topic?
Watch the space.
Watch the space, exactly. And at that age, you know, health and everything considered, she's there for a long time.
I'd say so. I'd say that she is. Just one last comment to what Simon was saying. You are right. And I think...
That's where we should end it. That's excellent. Let's end it right there. Yeah.
Shortest panel ever.
There is this tension, right, between conservative and radical and so forth. And but it's, you know, it's nothing new, really. They've had to contend with those issues. And look, one of the ones was just even in Parliament, where one of the young Māori MPs really spoke in a way, and that was another one of the talk down on the paipai there, that sometimes young people just overstep their mark, and people actually did feel the disrespect that was spoken out. And so, yeah, interesting times.
Hmm. Tourist levy to enter New Zealand to be hiked by nearly, wait for it, 200%. Marie.
Yes. It's one of the latest measures. And I will be very intrigued to see both you, Alfred, and Simon, your thoughts on this, having been in that camp. So they're looking at increasing this tourism levy. Matt Ducey, speaking on Newstalk ZB, said it won't significantly impact the number of tourists arriving to New Zealand. However, across Rebecca Ingram, the chief executive of tourism industry Aotearoa, said the move was disappointing and could dent our global competitiveness. She said their modelling has found an increase could result in 48,000 fewer visitor arrivals, and that's around $273 million of visitor spending out of the economy. Mind you, Ducey is saying the government's got an ambitious target to double exports over the next 10 years, and they've tasked Tourism New Zealand with growing the value of international tourism by $5 billion over the next 4 years in off-peak and shoulder seasons. They want to grow tourism, but they also want to do it with a social licence. So, of course, all of these things, and I see a term and a phrase like social licence, and having a show like Counterculture, my little spidey senses and heckles go right up, Simon. Is that justified, do you think?
Oh, I think it's not unreasonable. I think, look, they've made their call. We're going to have to wait and see what happens, because actually I can see the reasonableness on both sides. So, you know, the minister, the government saying, look, it doesn't really matter what we do with the price. Tourists want to come to New Zealand, so they'll just pay it. But on the flip side, as you say, other organisations going, whoa, it's pretty challenging. I think the key is, well, two observations really quickly. One is we know a lot of the key tourist areas, such as where the RCR studio is, gets overwhelmed at times. But the other side is that the government needs to have a further plan of how you get, if you will, high-value tourists in. In other words, you want people who want to come here, stay for a week, spend a lot of money, not people who turn up for 3 days, have a look and leave. So it's got to go hand in hand, but I'm not completely against the idea. Elder decision.
They say here by increasing the international visitor levy means that they can continue to support international tourism, economic growth, while ensuring international visitors contribute to the high-value conservation areas and projects, such as supporting biodiversity in national parks and other visited areas, improving visitor experiences on public conservation land. Now, that all sounds great. My worry is, how are they going to measure it and also let us know that that money is actually being spent in those areas?
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I agree with you, Marie. See, Simon, I've shifted from you. Did you notice that?
I can't take it.
No, I agree with the comment that you're making, Marie, because, look, one of the things is that a lot of our international travellers travel to New Zealand because it depends on where the New Zealand dollar is, right? And if we're weak in the dollar, right, then obviously we get an influx of people coming in because they get a bigger bang for their buck. So we're still in what's called a technical recession. I don't think that now's the time, right, to start to actually put even the smallest of burdens on our tourist industry. It's just starting to grow over COVID. We're now starting the numbers starting to grow again. Why would you do that? Why would you signal? There are other ways to generate, you know, tax revenue. I just don't think that this is one of them. I just believe, and you're right. So how do you measure that? It's all fluffy ducks when you turn around and say, oh, yeah, we're going to do this for the environment. Well, Simon and I know there are different portfolios, right, that have warrants that have that responsibility, and this is not one of them. You don't turn around and say, oh, yeah, well, we're going to sort of clip the ticket, take that, and then we're going to do something good for the environment. And biodiversity, I mean, seriously, what are you going to do? There's no room for it. Let the people come. Let our tourist industries begin to flourish and grow again, right? And when we're in a better place, then consider maybe possibly another way of doing it. But I actually think it's a dumb idea. Mm-hmm. Oh, there we go.
Well,
I also
worry as well. I covered a story with Media Matters last week, this week, just gone, and it was around the protesters now with the cruise ship season coming up. So all of these eco-protesters, and there was one group that went from protesting railways and they couldn't get traction, excuse the pun, on that. So they've now moved to cruise ships, and they are, because the ports of Auckland, where most disembarkations or embarkations for New Zealand occur, they are now protesting on public land and they can't remove them. And of course, I mean, I'm actually somebody that likes cruising. I've been on several cruises, and there is something, there's nothing worse when you actually get off and there's some sort of protest or something going on.
Yeah, that
it's
wouldn't
not
be
a good
very
look.
Welcoming. No,
no. No. And I mean, if that's your first port of call or your last port, you've come over from Australia, had a beautiful holiday, you've cruised around New Zealand, you've done the sounds, you've come up the South Island, you've completed in Auckland, and you get off to find a young girl standing there covered in fake blood, you know, saying that your cruise holiday is my, you know, my climate hell. It's not exactly the image that we want to portray. And if they're having to pay extra to come here, it's sort of, I just feel like it's, we're overemphasizing our cachet, our tourist cachet with these people. And I think they'll, if we're to make it too hard, they'll go elsewhere.
Shouldn't we actually logically make it cheaper? One thing I've noticed in being in Queenstown is that things are cheaper in the supermarkets. And I'm telling you, they are. And around some of the deals and pubs and everything, quite cheap. And I questioned someone, a local, about that. And I said, well, from where I came from, it's even in the supermarkets, quite a bit more expensive. You notice the difference. And they said, oh, well, that's because tourists, you know, we want to make it competitive for tourists. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but maybe we should make it cheaper.
Yeah, I think the key is if we're going to charge the money, and to Marie's point, it's got to be what they call ring-fenced. So Ducey's got to be able to stump up and say, okay, well, we've made this many millions of dollars, and this is particularly where it is going. I think that somewhat answers Alfred's point, because otherwise it will just go into a general bucket and disappear. And you'll know if it's doing that. Yeah, it'll go into potholes, endless potholes. But, you know, if I think Marie's touched on a key point, which is if the government keeps talking in fluffy language, you know that it's just going very generally. But if you can tie them down. I would just add, too, if we're going to end up with protesters at cruise ships, that's going to do far more damage than any dollar amount. But I'd make the distinction, because I know a lot of people value protest. I would say these guys are just there to harass. Maybe listeners think I'm splitting hairs there, but I don't really see a protest if that's what they're going to do. They're just there to harass and be. Are you allowed to say? No, actually, I won't. You. This is radio, family radio. I'm not going to say the next words.
Well, so that's the concern when it says biodiversity in national parks and other highly visited areas, improving visitor experiences on public conservation land. Surely, as Alfred said, there is funding. I mean, is this just to plug gaps in the conservation budget and the tourism budget? I just sort of see it's a robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Well, we had this, the Auckland regional fuel tax, Paul. Do you remember that? And so it was all the promise that actually that fund with the regional fuel tax, extra 12 cents, you know, per litre. And somehow it was going to fix all the potholes, make better infrastructure. So and it never did. So and that's because they're all good ideas. But unless they've actually, you know, had a good feasibility, you've got a good plan knowing how to implement it. It's just a press release.
Mm. Yeah. And that person protesting on the wharf jumps on the Waiheke ferry powered by diesel, goes home. Probably. Okay, anything more to say about that? Are we done with that one? Because I'm really looking forward to hearing what people have to say about this. And that is the SIS have put out their latest security threat environment report. We've had a few comms on this from listeners over the last day or so, noting China is a big issue, but also some other nation states. And I think they talked about white extremism as well. Simon, what do you think about this?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, it's their annual report, nothing particularly unusual in that. Mm. I think, you know, the international side of things, I'm personally very pleased that they're calling China out quite assertively, along with Russia and others. You know, a number of us, myself included, if I'm not sounding a bit vain, have for years talked about the corruption within Chinese media, and actually this report talks about it, a lot of it controlled by Beijing, the coercion. All of these things, they even obliquely reference the two Chinese police stations that I've mentioned being in New Zealand. So long and short, there's some really good things there. But it gets a little bit more, for me, waffly when they move into what they call violent extremism. And, you know, most of us will be familiar with this faith-motivated violent extremism, which is primarily Islamic violence. And let's be clear, the Western world has a problem with this at the moment, and it's the major problem. But what we're seeing in this report is the usual, trying to then circle it with a whole lot of other events or groups. So identity-motivated violent extremism, which is like white nationalism, and then what they call politically motivated violent extremists. So are there examples of that in New Zealand? Absolutely. But trying to sort of conflate all three as being equal threats, to me personally, misses the point. And I'd much prefer that our intelligence services focus in where the real issues are and not, if you will, trying to be equitable. So there's that. I mean, it's about 60 pages of a report. You can read it. It is public. Most of it's what you'd, and Alfred will know this too, if I'm not throwing him in it. There's lots of words, but it doesn't always say much. But I'll return to where I did start. There are some good points, and it's quite a big deal, actually, Paul, for our intelligence agencies to call out other nation states. That's a big deal. And actually today, I'm getting mixed up with this week because it was Friday today. Long and short, China's reacting. They've already put out press releases at New Zealand's government saying could be consequences.
Right.
So I hope the government. Expect it. I just hope New Zealand holds the line. But that's me.
Them calling out China, does that mean there's even more of an issue with them than you'd think to get to a threshold of calling them out?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, what we do know, as I say, a lot of these, not all, but a lot of the Chinese associations are controlled by what they call the United Front Working Group, part of the Ministry of State Securities. Well, I had my emails targeted, as did Louisa Wall. We know that China's targeted parliament services. We know they harass democracy activists. And, you know, fair call to the SAS. They referenced all of those. But that's just a tip of an iceberg, as you can imagine. But the key point is, for me, focus on those things. Don't get distracted by other areas which are actually not the same equivalence. That's the big thing.
You know what I found really funny, Simon? It's so funny you mentioned that, because Radio New Zealand obviously couldn't find the gender-neutral gonads in all of this, because what you just said, they clearly outlined it. This is what RNZ summarised it as. New Zealand's unique place and role in the Pacific can make us vulnerable to activities of other states striving for influence and position throughout the region, followed on by a small number of foreign states conduct interference and espionage in and against New Zealand and New Zealanders. These states seek to disrupt the rights of New Zealanders, including their right to freedom of expression. That's how they summed that up. It's just like, for goodness sake, people, just you put your big boy and girl pants on and, you know, say what's in the report.
Yep. They've reversed it, actually, when you're listening to that RNZ. Well, sorry, what you've just read out is actually reversed in many ways what the report is saying.
So what I want to know is, am I off terrorist watch list now? Because I think I was there last time, you know, long hair, Instagram, likes to knit, crafts, cooks at home, looks after their own children. Am I still a threat, or have we dropped off?
Well, I'll go and have a look. The list is getting longer.
Yeah, you should be a category. Yeah, let's,
jokes aside, you know, if people like yourself, Marie, are on those lists, then something is completely wrong with our systems. I know myself haven't been on it on a good way, despite some of my stances on things, but they're not. Well, I wasn't allowed to. Alfred would know this. They're not allowed to watch MPs. But granted, I've been out a year now. Who knows?
Well, I'm like you, Murray. Yeah. I'm on the list because I'm a, you know, they'd call me a conservative Christian.
How dare you, Alfred?
I know, but they failed to call me a white extremist. That sort of just didn't fit. Look, I think from my point of view, New Zealand's in a catch-22, like many nations in the Pacific, right? China is our largest trading partner. So whether we like it or not, we've now got this dance that we've got to play, this geopolitical dance. Well, on one hand, we have to show the sovereignty of our own determination, where we can actually stand up and make a voice and say, actually, we don't like this, it's wrong, while at the same time, too, we're still having, you know, backroom conversations about how this FTA can continue to allow us to trade. I mean, Australia used to be our largest trading partner. It still is China. So we've got to be careful. But I actually think what the report also does, it reinforces some of the concerns and some of the direction that, you know, the current coalition government. We're having this conversation around AUKUS, for instance, in Pillar 2, because AUKUS was its initiative was to look at the threat of China in the Indo-Pacific region. You think about that at the Pacific Forum recently, the whole thing around Pacific policing. Why? Because, as Albanese said, right, there is a threat that's there, and it's called China. And next thing you know, he's with Kurt Campbell, and he's having, you know, backroom bilateral conversations to talk about what we can do to strengthen our trade and da-da-da, and safety and security. So, look, it'll go both ways because China needs to be very careful too because it needs, you know, its relationship in the Pacific. So I think this is going to take political, as you said, marine sort of gonads, a backbone, a spine, to be able to actually still stand and have a clear sovereign position to call out the things that we don't like, while at the same time too, we've still got to be able to trade our way. I think that's where the CPT, well, isn't it amazing? Simon, we're part of the government where it was the TPP. Remember, they were marching on the streets, protesting and said, oh, this is going to remove our sovereignty. And all of a sudden, when, you know, Labor got in power, they added two little letters, CPTPP. We had
Halcyon days.
Oh, and PACER Plus was around basically broadening our trading partners, both in the Pacific region and also abroad, and that's what we need to do. So I just hope that the current coalition is developing that. I know that Todd is actually doing a good job trying to get out there to increase that, but look, it's a difficult dance, and you've just got to keep working away until you can get a better position.
So I agree with you, Simon. I think the strong language is good. I think, and Luxon too has also, when the minister came and visited, he again brought up some issues. But as we dance this dance and apply pressure from New Zealand, will the Chinese then apply more pressure on our Pacific neighbours in terms of Belt and Road type initiatives and new wharves and the like to apply pressure to us that way?
Look, most definitely. Look, it's good to see the government speaking more robustly about this. When we had the number two from China visit a few months back, Luxon's hand was twisted a little bit because, well, some news was released around the same time about MPs and academics and others being targeted, so he had to say something. Look, the pressure is all throughout the Pacific. Debt traps is one of the big, big ones. You've got a very pro-China government in the Solomons. They've been actively trying to harass within the Pacific Island Forum the presence of Taiwan, for example. Yeah, it's a big, big challenge. And ultimately, we'll know the hard way if New Zealand steps over the line in China's mind, because they'll hit us with some trade barriers. We've had it before. Apple's meat all of a sudden can't be exported. There's all of these new licenses required that we forgot to tell you about.
Meat sitting on ships out of the coast and going rotten. Yeah.
But our sovereignty is the most important thing. So Alfred's right. And for listeners to understand, of course we want to trade with China. By the way, it's actually going down. That's something that they don't often say. Trade with China is going down. But our sovereignty and our national security, to me, are the most important. And I'm not, you know, I've been quite vocal about this. I'm not prepared to sell New Zealand out to the highest bidder. So New Zealand, got to find more trading partners. And it's good they're out there talking, but we need to see some delivery too.
As I'm in the day job, I've got a business and we do actually do some manufacturing contracting with China. So we have a little bit of experience there. And one of the things that I've noticed in the number of years, particularly in the last 5 or so years that we've been dealing with them in my part of the business, is that there is certainly more of a hunger there at the moment. I think they're feeling the pinch, the global financial pinch at the moment, just as much, if not more, than what we are here. And you don't necessarily hear about the effects because of how tight their media is, and they're very, very curated in what they report. But the behaviours of what I'm seeing in our business relationships, they are certainly more furtive than they have been in the past.
Look really quickly, the Chinese economy is struggling, and it's a communist regime. So you've nailed it, Marie. They will announce what their growth is, because that's just what we've said. The Politburo says it's 7%. Oh, lovely. Often it's not the case. And, you know, what you've just shared doesn't completely surprise me. And I suspect it doesn't surprise a lot of economists either. You know, the Chinese economy is struggling. And that has an impact on us too.
Are they bad, though? Because, you know, we're talking about their tentacles in the Pacific and Belt and Road and all that. But, you know, they've got a right to do that if they can. And if other countries in our area want to accept those projects and that infrastructure, that's up to them.
Yep. I mean, these other nations are sovereign states. They can make their decisions, but they've also got to realise it comes with a lot of ties. So, you know, New Zealand's generally pretty open. Here's $1 million to go and fix your airstrip. That's the end of it. Whereas China's coming often with a lot of additional requirements. Yeah, and I don't see a moral equivalence. I'm not saying New Zealand's perfect, but, you know, we're a democracy, generally speaking. They're not. It's a whole different set of values. So are they bad, the communist regime? Yes.
Okay, there you go. Alfred,
took me a while to get there.
Do you want to answer that one?
Oh, I just
China, good or bad?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, good and bad is too black and white in one sense because there's a lot of nuancing in here. And it's not 50 Shades of Grey, but I have to say that, you know, you've got countries like Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, for instance, and you see that they're struggling in their own economies. And so they are, and they have been trading. There are soft loans that are currently out there at the moment, right throughout the whole of the Pacific. But I just want to say that while we've spent a lot of time on China, Simon raised an issue around, I suppose, you know, and people out there would call him Islamophobic and use that word. But actually, there's a point to what he's raising. We had the president of Qatar visit, and, you know, 2 weeks ago before the Pacific Forum, and he was very clear that he wanted to also talk about, because it was in Luxon's press release, just about some of the negotiations in the Middle East. And so we've now got these geopolitical sort of levies that are happening. Now, currently, our trade with Qatar is about $90 million. But more importantly, it's the, I believe, with the UN and United Nations Security Council, there's a lot of lobbying around the votes and the support that people are looking for, particular areas. We, at the moment, we've got 90% of our abattoirs, our freezing works, are using halal killing, right? If you look now, AFCO are now openly talking about halal butchers. So there's we're currently with New Zealand Tourism, who go to tourism. New Zealand Tourism in 2020 basically put out a tourist map for those coming from Islamic countries. Nothing wrong with that, but we've now got 65 mosques and prayer halls now right throughout the country. Now, I'm not turning around and saying that, is it? But there's a real, you know, they only make up 1% of a population, but they're starting to sort of, the ideas that are coming through, I think, are something we just need to be mindful about that. And as Simon said, other countries are now struggling, France, England. Why? Because while it starts off soft and caring and kind and cuddly, it actually often ends up in a more of an extremist mode. And that ideology with Sharia law and so forth goes against all the values, you know, that we've been founded on as a country. So I just want to put myself out, and I'm going to be labelled now like you, Simon, but you started first, so anyway.
Oh, that's all right. They called Larry Elder the new face of white supremacy. Maybe that could be, you could be the New Zealand version of that, Alfred.
Alfred and I collect labels. Guitar. We try to see how many labels we can collect between us.
Well, I wonder, you know, if RCR hosts are on any of these lists.
Oh, we're bound to be.
Because of what we say and dare to talk about.
Well, someone's got to say it, and I think that, you know, there is a bravery there, and courage is a funny old thing, isn't it? And I really wish I could see more courage in politics. And I mean, for me, I know this isn't on the list, but for me, the last week or so, old Uncle Shane, for me, calling out the judiciary and, you know, making a statement of fact, as he believed, in terms of the communist leanings of one of the justices. I mean, that's brave. And we need, and yes, I know Judith has probably had quiet words and Winston's had a wee whisper in his mate's ear, but sometimes they're playing it too safe. I mean, Simon, you've been known to make a sparky speech from time to time. I mean, what are your thoughts on Shane's comments in the House last week?
I think they were, I'm fine with them. Is the long and the short. I actually want to see more characters in Parliament. I mean, we won't have time to go down the rabbit hole on this one, but I think MMP in particular sort of suck the life out of Parliament. It's basically just all managed now. What the party leaders want is what everyone else says. So it's wonderful to have a bit of a character speaking their mind. And, I mean, is he affecting what they call comity So not comedy, comedy. You know, you're not meant to say things about judges. Yeah, you got close. But you know what? The judges, a lot of them are actually doing things. I might not be saying things, but they're doing things, which actually are attacking Parliament.
Well, they're not gods.
No, they're not. Exactly right. The only thing, Paul, is they're not allowed to comment back. That's part of the reason there's meant to be this.
Who don't sign up for the job then?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I'm comfortable with what he said. You see, he doubled down afterwards. So he went from calling them communists to the totalitarians.
Yeah, he's not backward and coming forward.
I agree with you, Marie. I think that he's probably my favourite politician at the moment. Because it's not just the wit, but there's an intelligence behind what he's talking about. When he turned around and they said, well, what about climate change? They said, I'm sick of all that talk. I want to get on to the business, right? You know, and so I believe that he reflects the frustration of many Kiwis, right? And it has become a bit of a comedy fest, right, where people are just going from left to right and this and that. And he said, let's just get on with doing what Kiwis need. Mums and dads, cost of living is a big issue. Let's make sure that we start generating revenue so that we can help our people, lower inflation. You know, let's just get back on to doing what makes a difference for our people and our communities. I really like that. And I know people I know, they like that too.
Mm. Must be doing good things for the support for New Zealand First.
Yeah, some of the recent polls have actually indicated, is it Roy Morgan? I mean, he's... Won't get into the depths of polls, but actually they're up. But O'Shane's, he's actually just a lovely guy too. He's, as Alfred said, he's got enormous intellect, which is why I think actually he's able to speak so articulately. And, yeah, as I keep saying, it's good to have characters in Parliament. You want people to speak freely. Oh, sorry, that sounds like an advertisement. You want people
it's
to
your show.
It's on my mind.
Yeah. Let's this sort of dovetails well. Pacific Islands Forum finished last week, Taiwan included as an observer. So they got China pretty grumpy, right, Alf?
Yeah, look, it's all part of the geopolitical conversation we've been having. You know, New Zealand, along with other countries, have what they call a one-China policy, right? And so it's really important. And I remember travelling to Taipei, and we don't have an ambassadorial office there. What we actually have is a trade office, right? And it's a way of sort of making sure that we can sort of, again, it's another dance again. Here we go. But again, it's a good example when some of the smaller island nations have now forged some form of relationship with Taiwan in the forms of trade and now wanting to include them simply as an observer, and China's trying to flex a bit of political muscle and say, no way. So, I think that one of the things that I've seen in talking to some of these smaller island leaders is that they're starting to see the collective power that they can have when they speak with one voice. That's why the PIF, the Pacific Islands Forum, is actually important. 18 Pacific nations, obviously Australia and New Zealand are the two larger nations, but they're starting to now. I was talking to Mark Brown the other day, and he was saying that they're starting to say, if we hang together, right, we have a stronger voice collectively than we are divided. And so they're now starting to, some of them are starting to push back.
Right. Anyone else got observations on the PIF?
Well, when you were talking to Mark Brown, I know that he was really vocal during the time of the pandemic to try and get tourism back going in the Cook Islands, and they had a massive vaccination campaign, pretty much got all of Rarotonga vaccinated. Did he talk about how the recovery there has been going with tourism? I mean, here in New Zealand, we're at 80%. Did he indicate where the Cooks were sitting at now?
Yeah, look, I've been back on a couple of occasions already. And definitely talking to a lot of the tourists. And so the occupational rates for a lot of the hoteliers is now up to 75% and in climbing. They're now starting to get, they're now getting extra flights coming from Australia. So Jetstar's now flying through. On some days, you can get up to 6 flights coming in and out of Rarotonga. So things are definitely picking up. And so, yeah, the COVID's another thing. I didn't agree with the position that they took. I think the mandates were just far too hard on a lot of the people. But you know, they're slowly recovering. The big thing over there, Marie, is that is the manganese nodules at the moment. Mm-hmm. So it's around the mining. So they've got an exploratory. So there's two outfits at the moment that are looking at sort of developing the technology. And I think that's what they're looking at. They are, the concern is, could that become another Nauru Island, right? So where all of a sudden you've got this incredible resource, by the way, never been mined at those sorts of depths before. We're talking about, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 kilometers deep. It's incredible. But no one knows the ecological impact that that could have. So while tourism's picking up, I think they are definitely putting some focus around the potential gains that could have towards this exploratory of the manganese nodules. Mm.
I thought that was a medical condition when you first said it. Like you got around your neck or something. Your voice box. Okay, Kamala Harris does first interview, only 18 minutes long, with her vice president or vice president running mate, Tim, what's his name? Apparently, Simon, that was 42 minutes of content edited down to 18. I know mainstream media love to do the editing, but that's slash and burn. Something must have been wrong with that interview.
Yeah, you have to wonder. I mean, look, fundamentally, I'm just amazed that we're – I mean, look, it's American politics, but you've got a woman who is the vice president. She is now running to be the president along with Tim Walz. And that's for how many, was it days? No, sorry, apologies, weeks and weeks. No interviews, period. I mean, it's ridiculous. The other side, you know, Trump and Vance, not even having to wave flags for them, but, you know, almost daily, which you'd expect, you know, here in New Zealand, both political parties, the leaders can't shut up. But it's extraordinary to me that she waited so long and then, well, I don't care that it got cut to 18 at one level. Even that's not enough. 42's not enough.
Yep. And you bought a couple of hours, right? A couple of hours would do.
Yeah,
absolutely. With questions.
Yeah, but I mean, that was the window of time that they had to wait for her to sober up, wasn't it?
Okay.
I'm sorry. Whenever she does speak, I think she's quite the day drinker. That's just an observation. I don't know that for fact, but she always feels like she's had one or two slugs of, you know, the sea juice, which I'm very fond of. But yeah, it was 18 minutes. I certainly didn't get back. And highly curated, and I'm loving actually after that interview came out, there was a series of little spot interviews asking people what, you know, are you going to vote for Harris? Oh yes, I love her, I love her. Name some policies and things that she's put through. She's done nothing. She's done nothing. And people know she's done that. You know, they're
Well, she did quite a bit in California when she was Attorney General.
When she was sleeping with the mayor of San Francisco.
Yeah, and climbing up the ladder and putting black, African-American guys in, or keeping them in jail longer on not very serious offences.
A lot of it was marijuana stuff. Crazy. Yeah.
And isn't it interesting? It's always the way. The woman interviewing her, Dana Bash, was she ABC or CNN? One of the two.
ABC, I think.
ABC. Her husband, forget the name, was one of the 51 who put their name, their signature to the letter, claiming that Hunter Biden's laptop story was a Russian propaganda effort. So, you know, they're all in it kind of together, it seems.
Well, even the way she interviewed compared to how she interviewed J.D. Vance, again, it's all very different. But let's be clear, it's actually working. For Kamala, her poll numbers are relatively good, certainly better than Biden's. That the small target is working. Look, political parties here have done it. National was a small target campaign, Albanese in Australia, which by and large means that as political parties you don't say much, and that's what she's doing. She's not saying much. She's not releasing policy. It's just all big fluffy words and minimizing the target. And yeah, it at this point. At this point, it's working for her. But just quickly, too, we haven't even heard from the president. Biden's on the beach in Delaware.
Is he actually the president?
Well, we know there's others pulling the strings there. But it's just extraordinary. You know, the most powerful man in the earth, end quote, is absent. It's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And when he's there, he's not there anyway.
But I wasn't going to go there, but now you have.
Yeah. What do we make of that? It's a legitimate question. Who's running the free world right now?
It'll be officials,
yeah,
basically, and senior influencers within the Democratic party, and it would have been for a while. I mean, it was been for me, it's been sad to see the cognitive decline of Biden. And as you know, many of us have touched on before, we've been gaslit for years now for saying, hey, there's a problem. There is no way that he's been able to run the show. It will be, again, key advisors, senior Democrats. Doesn't actually appear to be Harris. She doesn't seem to have had any influence despite being the VP. But again, quite worrying, as I say. No comments, no nothing. Silence from the White House.
Well, they're also in that situation in this term in the fact that they hold the Senate, but they don't hold the House. So, you know, there's not a lot that they can do other than paddle around at the beach in Delaware and her cackle away through a couple of bottles of Chardonnay and saying, sweet bugger all. So they're really just, I think, biding time and hoping that their base is going to bang the drum loud enough to get them across the line in November. It will be interesting to see what the two, RFK Jr.'s endorsement and now Tulsi Gabbard's endorsement will do, because there are a lot of Democrats, what I would call those in the classical liberal space, who really are not enamoured with the current party, and they need to feel that they are giving their vote, even if it is to the Republicans. It's not necessarily to Trump, but it's if they can see that someone like Gabbard or RFK Jr. get a position in an administration, yep. I think that would pull those votes over. And I do wonder whether that is a ploy that they will play to get all those classic liberal voters who are fed up.
Naomi Wolf said last week when we were talking to her, it's the white female that will determine this election.
Mm-hmm. And you know what?
That speaks to what you were saying, Simon, yeah. You know, the narrow kind of focus.
But that group, it's interesting, that group, Paul, because that group is, I mean, we've seen them in this country and they're awfully fond of Chloe et al. But also over there, they have swung elections in the other direction. I mean, Glenn Youngkin won in Virginia off the basis of those Moms for Liberty. So they're quite a powerful subset on both sides. So it really,
Which way do they go?
Which way do the moms go?
I got to say, I really enjoyed listening to you speaking with Doug Casey. Wow.
Yeah, he's
boy,
lovely.
Was that an eye-opener. I'm just talking about this, thought of that, because he was pessimistic. He said, I'm actually pessimistic about all of this.
Yeah, he is. Anyway. And he's calling a Kamala win. He wants to be wrong, but he's, you know, he looks at multiple sets of different factions in terms of his speculating. And he's saying things are going to get worse before they get better.
Alfred, any observation about, did you see that interview, the whole Kamala thing? What do you make of it?
You know, they say that 80% of communication is nonverbal. Yeah, I wish you'd just be nonverbal. I think we'd enjoy it more, because like Marie, you're just not going to get it back. Incredibly painful. Look, just that comment about, you know, what swings and target votes, Simon will know this. They used to, in polling, they used to say that, they used to call them the, well, your average tradie, you know, middle New Zealand. But then there was a subset called the Epsom housewife. And it was the middle of the road, right? Not quite, Marie, what, you know, the whole sort of disinformation sort of profile that they had for you and others, but they'd call them the Epsom housewife. And what they'd say was this. They said that they were the ones that turned around and said, obviously, because they were traditionally national voters, they'd vote right. But then they'd give, and that would be their electorate vote, but they'd give their party vote to the Greens, because they were trying to stroke a social conscience, and that was the way they could say, I can do something for the environment. So, you know, politics is
that
quite
was a big mistake.
Sorry?
That was a big mistake, wasn't it?
Yeah. But what it means is that a lot of messaging now is focused to try and understand, I suppose, the psychology, the thinking of what sort of ordinary New Zealanders are, and you've got these different target groups about what that could be. And look, it happened with the Māori Party, right? They're very clever in last year's election, and hence the reasons why they won 6 out of the 7 seats, because they knew how to target towards the young, emerging Māori voters that were coming through, and hence the reasons why they got through. So targeting is just part of that political sort of campaigning that's happening at the moment.
That's so euphemistic, targeting. I mean, I think some of the Labour Party are calling it something a little bit different with the Electoral Commission at the moment, aren't they?
Hey, we're up against time, folks, so let's call time. I want to thank Alfred Ngaro. Thank you, Al, for coming back on.
Great to be here, Paul.
Simon, get ready for Speak Free. We'll let you go now.
Tremendous. Thanks so much. Lovely to chat.
And Marie, keep up the great work, Marie.
Thanks, Paul. It's been great. It's been a while. I've enjoyed being back.
Didn't it flash by the time?
I know.
Yeah. All right. And we'll do another political panel this time next week here at RCR.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.